Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for tuning in today. We're going to talk about what kind of jobs will drive the next economy. What changes to expect on top of the ones we have already absorbed? Alec Ross, a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins, has written the book he wishes someone had put into his hands when he was growing up in West Virginia 3 decades ago. His new book draws on his 4 years of travels as Secretary of State Clinton's senior advisor on innovation, 500,000 miles traveled observing curve-bending developments in 41 countries. Ross gave his book the rather flat title, The Industries of the Future. Parts of it are breathlessly, gee whiz, look what's just around the corner. And parts of it tell a cautionary tale for middle-class workers in developed economies like the United States. Alec Ross joins us from New York. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
I'm very, very glad that we have a chance to talk to you. Let's start where you did with your growing up in West Virginia and what you learned in retrospect looking back on earning college money in Hurricane West Virginia?
That's right. Yeah, no, look, there's not an ounce of blue blood in this body. And when I was growing up, you know, working class, middle class in West Virginia, part of what I had to do in order to put myself through my fancy college was work as a midnight janitor and work on beer trucks while my college classmates were off doing unpaid internships in law firms, investment banks, or in congressional offices. So, you know, I grew up seeing how difficult the last stage of globalization was for rural America. And then after college, spent a couple years teaching in West Baltimore. So I saw how tough the last stage of globalization was for much of urban America.
Tell me more about the parallels that you saw between what you saw happen to West Virginia's economy and your own place in it, and what you saw with the kids you taught at Booker T. Washington Middle School in West Baltimore, right, as a Teach for America teacher.
That's right.
Well, I wouldn't think there's the same lessons there.
Oh, they're very similar. They're very similar. Following World War II, the United States entered into several decades of expansion of its middle class and upward economic mobility for the vast, vast majority of its population. And then beginning in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, we saw an acceleration of globalization driven in significant measure by technology. Now, this is a good thing. What's happened over the last 25, 30 years has lifted nearly a billion people out of poverty around the globe, and it has contributed substantially to America's economic growth. But there's a segment of America that has struggled, and that is working class America, where there's a relatively limited set of skills at play. And so both in West Virginia and in Baltimore, what we saw were the loss of those union wage jobs that you could get with the strength of your shoulders, at a port, at a factory, at a mill, in the case of West Virginia, in a coal mine. And so as the world, as our economy grew more technology rich and knowledge based, those jobs that you could get that were union wage, feed your family, only one parent working, had health care coverage, those largely evaporated. And so the men that I worked with on the midnight shift as a janitor, those were men who a decade or two prior would have been working in a coal mine. And in the community that I taught in West Baltimore, previously the hope would have been that you could have gotten a job with Bethlehem Steel or you could have gotten a job at the port. Instead, to the extent that there was any employment, it was in the service industry, folding bedsheets or bussing tables, near minimum wage, no benefits. And so it became much more difficult as people in Baltimore began competing against people in Bangalore and as coal miners began competing against machines. So though technology-propelled globalization was overwhelmingly good for the world, there was a big segment, working-class America, where it became very difficult to become any wealthier, any healthier, and any better off.
You take it a step further in your book. You tie the riot, the unrest that we saw in Baltimore last year to this same trend.
That's right. You know, I think that people from outside of Baltimore view this as exclusively a white and black issue along binary racial terms. And race really does matter in the context of the Freddie Gray riots. But there's something beneath that, and it's economic disenfranchisement. And what I really believe is that a lot of what propelled that rioting, when I talk to people who are in the middle of it and who have closely observed it, a lot of what propelled the rioting was a sense of isolation from opportunity and a sense of unfairness. And the reason why I wrote this book, The Industries of the Future, really is to respond to the anxiety that Americans feel. If you look at this presidential election, we see people going to the very far right, and we see other people going to the very far left. But what's driving them, in my opinion, is very similar. It's anxiety about the future, and it's a sense of unfairness. So if you are supporting one of the fascist candidates, Ted Cruz or Donald Trump, you're blaming immigrants or you're blaming people who are on Obamacare. And if you're on the very far left, you're blaming the 1%, you're blaming Wall Street. But they actually come from very similar places. They come from a place of anxiety and a sense of that there's economic unfairness in America.
That's Alec Ross, Distinguished Visiting Professor at Johns Hopkins, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book, The Industries of the Future. Are you excited or worried about coming changes in the economy? You can be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. The first of the next industries that you profile is robotics. You foresee robots not just replacing routine human tasks, but cognitive, non-repetitive work, and wiping out a lot of jobs that way. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I think the robots of the cartoons and movies from the 1970s are going to be the reality of the 2020s. And this is really being propelled by two things. The first is a mathematical breakthrough called mapping belief space. So there were things that were historically very difficult for robots to do, like grasping. Grasping might seem like a relatively simple task, but it's actually very complex to model out mathematically and algorithmically. But because of advances in mathematics, robots can now go from doing dominantly two-dimension to three-dimension activities. The second thing is cloud robotics. So, Sheila, if C-3PO from the movie walked into the studio right now and interrupted us, he would say, "Oh, excuse me, pardon me," and he'd go find a seat. In reality, in the C-3PO of the 2020s, that will be a network-connected device. It will be a cloud-based robot. And so if he walked into the studio, he would ping the cloud. The cloud would say, "Hey, C-3PO, excuse yourself. Excuse yourself in English and quietly go find a seat." And so what that means is that instead of having to have millions of dollars of very powerful hardware and software whirring in that gold gleaming body, what it means is that they can be relatively lightweight devices. And the fact that very sophisticated robotics can be done with lightweight devices means that it's easier to displace labor, because humans and robots have diametrically opposed cost structures. Humans are CapEx light, OpEx heavy, meaning that when you are hired by your employer, maybe they pay for business cards, maybe a computer, but it's not that much money. But there are a lot of operating expenses. Every 2 weeks, you want this thing called a salary. Robots are the exact opposite. A lot of capital expenses, a lot of CapEx, you've got to buy the big expensive robot. But after you buy the robot, you can work it for 24 hours a day. You don't have to pay it. It's not going to get sick. And so as robots grow less expensive because of cloud robotics, what that means is that there's a new equilibrium point, a new trade-off point between whether it's worth buying a robot or whether it's worth it hiring a human. And where I saw this, where I really learned about this, was of all places in coastal China at a company called Foxconn, which has 973,000 employees. They have these Raven Stadium size factories where they assemble all of our iPhones and Samsung Galaxy phones. And the CEO of Foxconn told me that he was not hiring any more humans, even though it was this cheap Chinese labor. He said, "I can now buy a robot for $14,000, so I'm not gonna hire any more low-cost Chinese people."
So you predict something like 5 million jobs wiped out by robots in the next 5 years, I think?
That's right. And here's the opportunity, though. You know, look, most people who write books about the future, it's either utopian or it's dystopian. It's either, oh, we're all going to grow up to be 150 years old, happy, healthy, wealthy, and wise, or it's written from the fetal position. Woe is us. We're all going to be in terrible shape. I think that The Industries of the Future is a balanced book in that I think that life is neither utopian nor dystopian. And while, yes, there will be jobs that are lost, there's an opportunity to create new jobs. So there are 196 countries around the world. If the United States becomes the headquarters cities, it has the headquarters cities for these robots, then, and we're exporting it to the other 195 countries, it can be overwhelmingly positive. So the question is, in a world that is growing increasingly driven by artificial intelligence and robotics, what does it mean for us? What does it mean for America?
And your answer to that?
I think it's going to be positive. I don't know what it means yet for Baltimore. There are other industries where I'm wildly optimistic for Baltimore, in cybersecurity, for example, and in genomics. In genomics, I could not be more optimistic. In terms of artificial intelligence and robotics, I see a lot of great things happening in California, in Massachusetts, in other parts of the country. But I think the Baltimore region is relatively underdeveloped in this respect.
So what do you see in cybersecurity for Baltimore?
In cybersecurity, because of the relative proximity of the NSA and the Defense Department and what have you, and because of a fairly decent amount of high-risk early-stage capital from the venture capital market, we are seeing a real surge in entrepreneurship in the cybersecurity space. And so there are going to be a lot of companies forming here and growing larger. And so the opportunity, let's tie this back to the Freddie Gray riots. The opportunity is to try to make sure that we rigorously develop the talent of our youth so that they can fill these jobs, so that it's not just people getting on airplanes, landing at BWI, getting their nice new home in Baltimore or in the suburbs, and then taking the cybersecurity job. There are so many openings right now and so many openings to come that if we really focus in our community colleges, for example, and if we really focus in our vocational education on ensuring that people from our working classes and people from our low-income communities have basic certificates in cybersecurity, then there's a huge market of jobs for them. And so I think that this is a field, since it is growing fast, and since the jobs, even without a college degree, can be high-paying, this is an opportunity for us to build on something.
We need to take a short break here. Alec Ross is our guest this hour. His new book, The Industries of the Future, and we have barely touched on them. I want to pick up on the curtain you raised on genomics when we come back. And I want to ask our listeners, do you agree that global competition and the digital revolution played a role in Baltimore's unrest last spring? We want to hear from you. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. On the line with us is Alec Ross, who describes Baltimore as his adopted home. He's a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins. His new book is The Industries of the Future. You can join this conversation. When you look back on it, do you wish that your parents had given you a better clue about where the economy was headed? tell us how that worked out for you. Our toll-free number is 866-661-9309, 866-661-9309. Our local number here in Baltimore, 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. I want to pick up on what you said about the genome, understanding our genes. You write that the science of understanding our genes and mapping them is moving much faster than creating drugs based on that new science. Explain why we should care about that.
We should care about it because the world's last trillion-dollar industry was created out of computer code, and the world's next trillion-dollar industry is going to be created out of genetic code. We're now about 15 years past the mapping of the human genome, and we are within 5 years of an explosion of the creation of what President Obama calls precision medicines. So right now, if you go to the doctor will give you one or two medicines, and if you're heavy, he'll give you one dosage. If you're skinny, he or she will give you a lower dosage. That's the extent of the personalization. But we're at a point now where we're able to draw so much data from our genes at a sufficiently low cost that we're getting close to a place where instead of just getting 200 milligrams of drug X, drugs can be developed that map to the specific genetics of your body and the specific genetics of an illness or what condition you have. And we also will be able to do some mind-blowing things diagnosing our illnesses. And the home globally for this is Baltimore, Maryland. I learned about this from somebody I play racquetball with at the Downtown Athletic Club every now and then. And when I first met him, I thought he was sort of a gym rat. You know, scraggly gray beard, wears a knee brace on the outside of his 1970s-style gray sweatpants, brings his racquetball gear to the court in a Samsonite suitcase. Turns out this guy, Dr. Bert Vogelstein, is, by some estimations, the world's most cited living scientist. It was his team at Johns Hopkins who decades ago determined how mutations in proteins cause cancer. And what he and others at Johns Hopkins have done in recent years is pioneered something called a liquid biopsy, where giving blood, just like I do every year at my annual checkup to check for my cholesterol levels, doctors can now observe cancerous cells at 1/100th the size of what can be detected by an MRI. What that means is that cancers that we routinely discover today in stages 3 and 4, we can discover early in stage 1 when they are much more curable. And what that means is that cancers that normally kill us will be able to treat much earlier and will live longer lives. And one thing that's particularly exciting about this is if we can commercialize the research that's taking place at Johns Hopkins and at the University of Maryland, Baltimore could be the Silicon Valley for the commercialization of genomics.
You say you learned about this from Dr. Vogelstein. You also learned about it from your uncle, Ray DiPaolo, who's head of the psychiatry department at Johns Hopkins.
That's right, Uncle Ray.
I don't call him Uncle Ray. That's what you call him in the book. But he has been a terrific source in explaining some issues of mental health to me. And I was really struck by what you wrote about the role the genome, understanding the genome, could play in mental health, especially you write about suicide prevention.
That's right. So, you know, the genetics of the brain are incredibly complex. And one of the things that, you know, my uncle Ray DiPaolo did at Johns Hopkins along with his teams were focus on the genetics of illnesses like manic depression. And some of the research that's come out of there is fairly fascinating. One thing, for example, is they discovered how people who commit suicide more often than not have a single protein that is misfiring. And we normally think of people who kill themselves, we say, oh, well, they're depressed, well, they're sad. And what's interesting is that the psychiatric geneticists at Johns Hopkins have figured out that Well, yes, maybe they were sad, maybe they were depressed, but they also had a very specific chemical imbalance. And so if you could develop a drug that inhibits the misfiring of this specific protein, then you could literally pop a pill that would make it less likely for somebody at risk of killing themselves to commit suicide. Now, that works entirely against the way that we normally think about something like suicide. But the research bears out the possibility for it. And so it's fascinating, you know, going beyond illnesses like cancer or Huntington's or what have you. It's interesting to think about things that we think of as being not rooted in the chemistry set, mental illnesses that we might be able to address with innovations in genomics.
But these pages to me in your book were part of what I look at as the gee whiz aspect of, wow, look what's coming. And I thought, yeah, right. Who is going to be able to afford, how many patients are going to be able to afford that kind of genetic mapping that will actually result in precision medicines perfect for them?
Sheila, you just got right to it. And this is a case where my book is, where the industries of the future is neither utopian nor dystopian. It's overwhelmingly the case that these innovations in the life sciences will benefit the wealthy first because they can pay for things outside of the context of their health insurance. And it will take years for them to be covered by insurance and for the costs to go down to a point where it really mainstreams. Now, I think that this will happen, but what it means as a practical matter is that wealthy Americans will have 5, 7, maybe 8 or 9 years of being able to benefit from these therapies before, you know, many of the rest of us. So, you know, in the work that I've done over the last couple of years, I've gotten to know some of the world's wealthiest people. And as I did my research for the industries of the future, I asked them, I said, when you get your annual checkup, do you get a liquid biopsy? And if they were very, very, very rich, the answer was always yes. When I ask any of my middle class friends, and I'm middle class, the answer is, what's a liquid biopsy?
Mm-hmm.
So I can already see how this innovation in the life sciences is skewing towards the very wealthy.
Well, that's kind of a recurring theme in your book, it seems to me, that the benefits of innovation, at least at first, go to the wealthy. And it's not clear to me how quickly they'll be redistributed.
I think that that's largely the case. There are exceptions to this. So there's a chapter in the Industries of the Future, for example, about big data, where I focus on agriculture. We live in a world right now of 7.2 billion people, and we will soon live in a world of 9 billion people. This means we need to produce 80% more food lest the world grow hungrier. And the best hope for being able to feed all of these people is through the application of big data analytics to agriculture, the creation of so-called precision agriculture. Now, this is a case where the principal beneficiaries are people who are hungry or at a nutrition benefit. But in general, you're absolutely right, Sheila, which is that the initial beneficiaries of innovation, both in terms of who gets the job, who makes the money from the stock shooting to the moon, who gets to actually use the products and services, it skews towards the wealthy. It exacerbates inequality. It then takes a number of years for it to mainstream, move through the middle class to the working class, and then occasionally, you know, into the lower income parts of our community and society.
That's Alec Ross here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book, In the Industries of the Future. And I'm wondering whether our listeners would like to be part of this conversation. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I was especially interested in what you wrote about the sharing economy, which is kind of a buzz phrase, people renting out their homes on Airbnb, hiring out their cars on Uber. In other words, taking part of their life and making it a way to produce income. You call it out. You write that there's nothing sharing about the sharing economy.
Yeah, try to be a part of the sharing economy without your credit card.
Good point.
I don't bash the sharing economy. You know, I'm in favor of people having more freedom. And I think that it really can benefit the middle class. If you've got an extra bedroom, for example, and you can rent that extra bedroom out to get some more money to help you pay the mortgage, God bless you. And I use Uber. You know, if you have more ride choices, you know, if there are an insufficient number of taxis, if you don't like the taxis, I believe that people should have the freedom of choice. But what I also believe, though, is that as more labor goes from being employer-based to, you know, quote-unquote gig-based to being a project-based, what that means is that there aren't workplace protections like workers' comp, like disability insurance, like if you get sick, you still get paid and other such things. And so the problem with the so-called sharing economy is that if larger and larger and larger percentages of the workforce do not have employer protections, then when something bad happens, it falls on the shoulders of government and therefore the taxpayers to fill the gap. You know, if anybody gets hurt on the job, there's not an employer you can turn to take care of you and continue to pay you and your family. And so much falls on the shoulders of the employee. And that's fine over the short term, but when people work for years and years and years and need pensions and need other sorts of workplace protections and they aren't there, I think that there'll be long-term implications for it.
About a month ago, we spoke with your Johns Hopkins colleague, Lester Spence, about his book, Knocking the Hustle, which focuses on exactly this, about the gig economy that everybody is expected these days, especially, he says, in disenfranchised communities, to be a brand of their own and to figure out how to monetize aspects of their life, how to make it a moneymaker. I was struck that you wrote, you said that some things which may in the past have been a casual favor, like giving somebody a place to stay, now become a monetary transaction, a financial transaction.
That's right. We're creating marketplaces out of everything and entrepreneurs out of everybody.
So when you say that it's not fair to that this burden then falls on the taxpayer when somebody needs protection, needs some kind of safety net support because they don't have a pension, they don't have the kinds of financial backing that a job, the security that a job would give them. What do you see as the answer to that?
I see the answer to this is it comes back to the broader dynamic around innovation. So in innovation, we see it's called more bounty and more spread. What that means is there's more wealth being created. We're going to live longer lives. We're going to have more stuff. But there's more spread. The economic beneficiaries of that are fairly few. You know, I'm struck by the example of photography, for example. Right now, everybody and their kid sister is walking around with a smartphone in their pocket, which has a camera. And we are taking, as a society, more photos than we've ever taken before. And that's enabled by things like Instagram. Now, I'm struck by the fact that the same month that Instagram was sold to Facebook for $1 billion, Eastman Kodak went out of business, filed for bankruptcy. When this took place, Instagram had a grand total of 20 employees. So 20 employees benefited from a $1 billion sale of the company. By contrast, Kodak, at its peak, had over 130,000 employees. So where we once had these industries where you could employ 130,000 people, we now are doing more than we ever did previously, but the employment base is only 20 employees. So in the face of this, and in the face of what you are describing, Sheila, with the sharing economy, what I believe is that we need to strengthen our safety net we need to re-examine in a world that has, in a country that has inherently more inequality, what are those things that we can do to prevent it from being the case that we have royalty, these super rich people, and then we have an ever-growing number of people who are disconnected from the economy. So we need to look at our safety net programs.
But you write about how some of these systems, like Airbnb or Uber, create wealth for the organizer of the app or the organizer of the platform on which the sharing can take place. Is there some way of capturing some of that wealth for the safety net, for those programs, for the taxpayer?
I think there needs to be. So let's talk, sticking to Airbnb and Uber for a moment. Those companies are now worth more than $40 billion each. And their founders, Brian Chesky at Airbnb and Travis Kalanick at Uber, are now, they aren't just billionaires. They're like multi-billionaires. And I don't have any problem with the fact that they're multi-billionaires. I'm a capitalist. I believe in a capitalist economy. But what I also believe is that their rates of taxation should not be lower than the person who picks up my garbage in the morning. And right now, because their benefits are valued as capital gains because of appreciated stock, they are. So right now, the person who works for Baltimore City who picks up my trash pays a higher percentage of his income than the billionaire founders of Uber and Airbnb. I think that's wrong.
We're going to take another quick break here. We're talking to Alec Ross about The Industries of the Future, his new book. I wonder whether our listeners agree with your analysis of how we can support the safety net, and if that means we need to change the tax structure. You can call us at 410-662-8780. That's our local number, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stick with us through this short break. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a new book, The Industries of the Future, by Alec Ross, who teaches at Johns Hopkins and who, with his wife, is raising a daughter and two sons. Is that right? A daughter and two
That's
sons
right.
in Baltimore?
13-year-old son. My 11-year-old daughter is the head of household, and a 9-year-old son.
Your 11-year-old daughter is head of household?
She thinks I'm an intern.
Gotcha. Okay, that probably matches a lot of families. David in Pikesville, I think, has an issue with a point you just made. David, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question for your guest is, I've really been thinking lately about our current conversation of kind of capitalism versus socialism. But I'm really starting I want to ask him basically, when it comes to capitalism, I think we kind of have with Uber this really kind of dogmatic sense of it, where we're really not allowing more traditional capitalism to give labor, all those Uber drivers, a little bit of opportunity to organize in their own interests to get a piece of that massive profit, as well as regulation, more so than taxes, which is general regulation. So what are your thoughts on kind of, when we talk about capitalism, understanding that labor and regulation are part of that stool? It's not just capital.
Labor and regulation as well as capital. Alec Ross?
Yeah. Yeah, no, David makes a very good point, and I agree with him. And I do think that Uber drivers have the right to collectively bargain. I have a feeling that their attempts to do so would be unsuccessful, just given the culture of Uber, but they certainly have the legal right to attempt to do so. But overall, his point is exactly spot on. Capital is not the only driver within capitalism. There are other forces, and he makes a very good observation.
Marty, David, thank you for calling us. Marty is calling us with some Uber experience. Marty, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was a driver for Uber for about 4 months, just recently quit, because Uber really does not take very good care of their drivers. They tell you that they charge 20%, but what they actually charge is 20% plus $1.45 fee. They recently raised that to 25% for new drivers. So So the advantage to it is it's a very easy job. They make it very, very simple. It's a very well-designed app that works, but drivers just aren't well taken care of. One of the other issues is insurance. For car insurance with the driver, I recently talked to my insurance company, and they said that for Uber, if I drive for Uber, if there is any accident at all that involves in any way, shape, or form Uber, I have absolutely no coverage from my insurance company. So Uber handles that in one respect, that they have insurance. But what they do is they break it down into three different segments of when I'm driving. When I have logged onto the app and say, okay, I'm ready to pick up passengers, stage two is I've accepted a call. Stage three is I have a passenger in the car. For stage one, they cover minimum Maryland insurance, which covers any sort of damage to other vehicles, injuries to other people, probably injuries to me, but absolutely nothing towards my car. That's all on me. Or anything above and beyond what Maryland minimum covers, that would be on me from the time I pick up a person, stage two and stage three. So both of those stages, they have $1 million liability policy that kicks in. But that policy covers, again, most everything. If I carry liability, or I'm sorry, collision and comprehensive.
Marty, we're kind of getting lost in the details of the insurance situation. You certainly have made it clear to us that you don't feel that Uber takes good care of its drivers. Let me ask Alec Ross, in your view of how the economy is moving forward, do you see this as sort of self-correcting, that an Uber platform will have to take better care of the humans who deliver the service, or is that not built into the cake?
I don't think they'll have to. I think that they won't have to, because what we have is a wave of young people and new immigrants who will always want those jobs. And after they're in the jobs for a few years, or after some period of time, they encounter difficulties, they find better jobs, they'll leave. But I think the pipeline of people who are willing to do this, you know, college students, for example, will be fairly constant. And so I think that it's something that could work well for people who want to do this over a limited period of time, for a limited period of time. But the worry goes to Marty's broader point, which is it's going to be really hard to make a career out of this, because there are so many gaps, and God help you when you do get in that car accident and you are sorting through the insurance issues. And so this is why I'm neither utopian nor dystopian about these companies. They do a lot of good, but we ought not say that this is the future of the economy and we should all embrace that. It also comes with a lot of pitfalls.
Jenny is calling us. Jenny, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Jenny, I hear you. You're on the air.
Okay, great. I have a very simple question. I had been listening to the discussion, and it made me remember a book I read in college, which was years ago, by Rawls, A Theory of Justice. And I was wondering if the commentator does know the book, and could he reflect on it? Because that book was written in either the late 50s or early 60s, and Rawls does talk about this situation where he discusses the fact that we would be moving, not that racial injustice is not still happening, but economic injustice becomes more apparent and the ramifications it has in society. And this is before the technological innovations of the last couple decades. It's late 50s, early 60s. I was wondering if he knew of it and if he had any thoughts of it. And I'll take my comments offline. Thanks.
Thanks, Jenny. So Jenny is asking about John Rawls'
right.
book about economic versus racial justice.
Right. So I haven't read that book. I've read lots of the literature from that period. And, you know, the point that I would make here is that it's drawn from a body of literature that looks at what the trends in post-World War II America were going to be. I think we're at an inflection point again. In the same way in which we were at an inflection point 20 years ago with digitization and the rise of the internet, I think that we are chapter one, page one in the industries of the future, from big data to cybersecurity to the commercialization of genomics, to other fields. And the reason why I wrote The Industries of the Future was to put some theory in there, but actually it was also to be accessible. So if people don't want to read a textbook, if they don't want to read an economic theory textbook or a computer engineering textbook, they want to read something that's entertaining, but can also give them some tools if they're a parent, for example, to say, all right, you know, my kids are in school. What should I be making sure they're getting in school? And if they're not getting in school, what do I need to be doing to help help make sure they're prepared for the future?
And that's exactly the next question I was planning to ask you. What can parents do to make their kids ready for the future?
Well, the first thing I will say is that if you are a parent and you're listening in today, know that the workforce that your child is going to enter when they leave school is very different than the one you entered and very different than the one that I entered. And so what my wife and I have done, my wife is a Baltimore City public school teacher at Roland Park. My three kids are all in public schools in the city, and they get a decent education. But there are some areas where they're lacking, and what we've had to do is supplement that outside of school. And I'd focus on two things. The first thing is languages, computer languages and foreign languages. All kids need to learn how to be coding. They need to learn how to be coding both because there is enormous job growth there and because it teaches you a way of problem solving. The second thing is foreign languages. The economy is growing more global. We work within the context of a 196-country chessboard. If your child knows how to speak foreign languages, they are much better positioned to be a player on that 196-country chessboard. And then the second thing I would say is they've got to be interdisciplinary learners. It's not all about science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Those skills need to be combined with some skills from the humanities, like communications and behavioral psychology. If you can help steward the interdisciplinary learning of your child, they'll be well positioned for tomorrow.
Tell me more about that, because certainly the sweep of your book, there is a lot of tech and data, big data, and the importance of analyzing big data. There's just a lot that would lead me to double down, tell my kids to double down on science and tech. And yet that's not what you conclude.
Well, you know, I think that that's important, and that's where the middle class job growth is going to be. But by the same token, I was a medieval history major, and I'm living a good life right now. And what I think is, as I have observed the CEOs, and when I was researching the industries of the future, I spoke with dozens of the world's most successful CEOs. What they have is they have a combination where they understand things that are technological and scientific, but they've also developed skills in the humanities. They're great teachers. They're great communicators. They're very good at understanding behavioral psychology. You know, one person who I've gotten to know a little bit is Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook. And everybody thinks of Mark Zuckerberg as this rock star computer scientist from Harvard, and he was. But as I've gotten to know him a little, I've become more and more convinced that the reason Facebook is as successful as it is has more to do with Mark's aptitude in behavioral psychology than it does with his aptitude in computer science.
This is a natural aptitude, or you think that from talking to him, do you think this is something that he worked at?
He has studied. You know, he studied at Harvard, and he has studied it since. It's just not as sexy to talk about as, you know, what he's done in computer science. But I continue to see him develop that side of himself academically. And if you look at his reading list, you know, he published his reading list for the year 2015. You get a little glimpse into the way that his brain works. And as I've gotten to know more of these CEOs, I see how they combine trying to stay current on what's happening technologically, but they also are studying psychology, sociology, history, and they're putting more and more emphasis on communication skills.
In this last chapter of The Industries of the Future, which is essentially a memo to parents about what they can do, you write that tomorrow's labor market will increasingly be a competition between humans and robots. How can today's kids win that competition?
They need to focus on those skills that can never be taken over by a robot. You know, it's interesting.
But if a robot is going to be connected to the cloud.
That's right.
That seems like the railroad race when the human pile driver is up against the machine.
That's exactly right. That's why we have to focus on things that, as of now at least, artificial intelligence has proven incapable of. For example, creativity, persuasion, things that involve emotional intelligence. You know, there's no indication of artificial intelligence ever being able to translate into emotional intelligence. So there are things that are distinctly human that can never be, that I at least hope can't and won't be replaced by machines. The more you study this, the scarier it is, but we have to think that there will always be a place for humans in all of this.
We're almost out of time, but I want to squeeze in this email we got from Paul in Hamilton. What about the future for workers with disabilities? What job possibilities?
You know, this is a really important question. There's good news and there's bad news here. The bad news is that we are requiring more, interestingly, in a world growing more connected, we are requiring more physical dynamism in our employees, in that, you know, people are having to move around the globe more and more to be global workers. You know, I've traveled over 1 million miles, you know, in the last 5 years, the equivalent of 2 round trips to the moon with a side trip to New Zealand. But the good news is that there is a sufficient amount of work that can be done from home at a computer, and assistive technologies are developing ever faster, that economic independence is growing easier for people with disabilities.
Alec Ross, we have to leave it there. We're almost out of time. The story of job destruction and renewal never ends, but this hour is coming to a close. So thank you. I want to thank Alec Ross for spending this hour with us. He's a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins. His new book is The Industries of the Future. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And I want to thank you, our listeners, for your comments and questions. Also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guests today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features a variety of sandwiches and salads, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you'll join us tomorrow. We'll step back for a broad look at work schedules and how much flexibility makes sense. That's tomorrow. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.